It is Friday, February 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Defense Secretary assures Japan and South Korea of Washington's commitment to Asia.
The U.S. is going to maintain its commitments, including the commitment to provide extended deterrence to its military allies in this region.
A Muslim American leader responds to President Donald Trump's refugee and travel ban for citizens of some countries, and we look at the difference between Silicon Valley and Asia's startup cultures. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis stressed Washington's commitment to support its allies in Northeast Asia against the growing nuclear threat from North Korea. Mattis visits South Korea and Japan on his first overseas trip since taking on his new job. I spoke with Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Padden in Seoul about the Mattis trip.
Well, it went well. He accomplished much of what he wanted to do. He made Northeast Asia his first destination for a foreign overseas trip since becoming Secretary of Defense, and he wanted to reassure allies and reinforce the message that the U.S. will stand by its allies in Northeast Asia. And I think he accomplished that to a significant degree.
Well, now, beginning in South Korea, Mattis spoke about any possible nuclear attack by North Korea on the U.S. or any of its allies. He said would be met with an effective and overwhelming response.
Yes, and if you read into that, I think that touches back on some uncertainty that was introduced into the possible commitment of the U.S. to maintain its security obligations in this part of the world. And that uncertainty was introduced by President Trump during the campaign and during his inauguration speech, when he indicated that they would not always support countries that do not pay their fair share for hosting American troops. And he made that point a couple times during the campaign. So I think what General Mattis wanted to say, he wanted to walk that back a little bit and say the U.S. is going to maintain its commitments, including the commitment to provide extended deterrence to its military allies in this region in particular. And that extended deterrence means that any attack from North Korea, nuclear attack on South Korea or Japan, would be responded to by the U.S. as well as these countries. And the U.S. would use the full array of its arsenals, both conventional weapons and nuclear weapons as well, to respond to a North Korean nuclear attack. So they wanted to put North Korea on notice that nothing has really changed. And he wanted to stress, actually, the continuity that the Trump administration will maintain in upholding the alliance, and the continuity from the Obama administration to the Trump administration.
And while he was there, Mattis also visited Seoul's National Cemetery.
Yes. Again, he wanted to set the tone. This was all about setting the tone. He wanted to make this a very formal, traditional visit between allies. These two countries go back to the 1950s during the Korean War, where thousands and thousands of American troops died to help protect South Korea from the North. And so what he wanted to, I think, stress with part of this visit was to say that these ties still bind both these two countries in this kind of unique, close relationship.
Later in the day, Mattis met in Tokyo with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, and he also seemed to reiterate that the United States backs Japan.
Yeah, and with the same message. I mean, there's 50,000 American troops in Japan. Most of those are there to help maintain security within the region, and in the recent years, also to kind of balance the growing military strength of China in the region. And so General Mattis wanted to, with his visit to Japan, to kind of emphasize that these relationships and these alliances and that they would remain in place. And the U.S. was not going to pull out troops, wasn't going to withdraw from its commitments anytime in the near or far future. And again, he was doing somewhat damage control because of President Trump's uncertain comments that he made during the campaign, where he speculated that maybe we don't need to have American troops out there, and maybe we need to allow Japan and South Korea to procure their own nuclear weapons so that they can defend themselves against these other nations. And why should the U.S. continue to be maintaining peace and security in this region when the U.S. is not really benefiting from these relationships the way it should? Now, there is likely to be some reassessment of the defense sharing costs out here in the region, and the Trump administration is most likely going to ask these countries to pay more of what Washington considers more of a fair share for hosting American troops overseas. But General Mattis, I think, with his visit here, is trying to indicate that these negotiations will not undermine the ongoing relationship and alliance.
That's VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Padden reporting from Seoul. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what is trending today?
Well, happy Friday, Sarah.
Happy Friday to you.
Of course, again, as we've seen, you know, all week, all several weeks, lots and lots of things in the news. And I'm just going to point this out. There is an item that's trending on social media. It is not very kind to the president's senior advisor, Kellyanne Conway. Now, I really do make an effort to look around for, you know, balance and what all kinds of people are saying out there. It does seem that this last week or two that the, generally speaking, opponents of President Trump really seem to have just kind of be, you know, in command of the social media space. Now, maybe that's just because he just took office. I don't know. But so anyway, that's a setup to this story that the hashtag Bowling Green Massacre. So last night, senior advisor Kellyanne Conway on MSNBC said the following, quote, two Iraqis came here to this country, were radicalized, and they were the masterminds behind the Bowling Green Massacre. Most people didn't know that because it didn't get covered. Well, it didn't get covered because it didn't happen. She was mixing up several items there, and none of them are true. Now, she, to her credit, she later came back. She said she misspoke. She didn't mean to say exactly what she meant. But, you know, social media is not a forgiving sphere sometimes. So a lot of people tweeting under this hashtag Bowling Green Massacre, and not kindly. Here's Meredith Guthrie. As a graduate of Bowling Green State University, I remember where I was during the Bowling Green Massacre. I was on the moon. Ryan Greger, as a tasteful tribute, I've had all of the hashtag Bowling Green Massacre victims' names tattooed on my back. Politicians are jumping into this as well. Here is a tweet from Adam Schiff, who's a congressman from the state of Democratic congressman from the state of California. He writes, where were you when Bowling Green Massacre didn't happen? I was in Stockholm getting a Nobel Prize. It was awesome. So a lot of people kind of again poking. And I think in some measure, because just last week, Kellyanne Conway had used the phrase alternate facts, in discussing a statement that Sean Spicer had meant. And that has just generated a tremendous amount of discussion about what she meant by alternate facts, what is an alternate fact, that kind of thing. So people jumping on that, on her, I imagine this will die down very quickly, and there will be plenty of stuff to talk about over the weekend. And, you know, let's not forget, we also have the Super Bowl coming up this weekend.
Oh, yes.
Yep. So I expect a lot of people to be talking about that. We'll see what happens on Monday when we take a survey.
Yeah, and Lady Gaga is the featured performer at the halftime show.
Exactly, and we have no idea what she may say or not say on a political bent. So we will see.
Very true. Thanks a lot, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The U.S. Treasury Department has announced new sanctions on Iran in response to the country's recent missile test launch. Residents of Islamic State-controlled Mosul risk lives to tell families of desperate need for food, water, and freedom. Afghan forces repulse a Taliban attack, and the U.S. unemployment rate rose slightly in January. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have discovered a new ancient bird species that lived in the Canadian Arctic some 90 million years ago during the Cretaceous period. The scientists describe this new ancient bird species as a cross between a large seagull and another diving bird species like a cormorant. They add that this creature probably had teeth as well. The new fossils, along with those gathered in the same area in the past, suggest that the birds made their home near a peaceful freshwater bay, which was also home to turtles, large freshwater fish, and a now-extinct crocodile-like reptiles called champosaurs. The scientists describe the climate in the Canadian Arctic some 90 to 84 million years ago as being similar to northern Florida today, that is warm through much of the year. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at the different business cultures of Silicon Valley and Asia. There's been wide reaction to U.S. President Donald Trump's executive order suspending refugee admissions to the United States. While highly unpopular overseas, the 90-day entry ban on citizens of seven countries is supported by roughly one-half of all Americans, according to polls. It's consistent with repeated promises made by Trump during his election campaign. In addition to suspending refugee admissions for 120 days and indefinitely for Syrian refugees, Trump's order also bans entry for 90 days to anyone from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Libya, Somalia, and Sudan. Dr. Zudi Jasser is the president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy and co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement. I asked him for his organization's reactions to the new Trump directive on refugees.
Well, basically, you know, we believe that this is not a Muslim ban. First, it's important to know what it is not. It is basically a pause from seven countries. There are 56 Muslim-majority countries, and Muslims are a quarter of the world's population. So the characterization of it as a Muslim ban is just incorrect. We do disagree with the indefinite delay on Syrians. The bottom line is that these countries, fine if we feel that they are hotspots, as the Obama administration labeled those seven countries. This is not a Trump determination. This was seven countries labeled as high risk before. The Obama administration had paused immigration of even refugees from Iraq before for 6 months. So I don't see this as an act that specifically is targeting any group of people. I do believe our vetting system has been hampered by a lack of filtering for ideologies of jihadism, of Wahhabism, and its current lens of simply violent extremism and adherence to terror groups is just not enough. So we support a better, more rigorous ideological vetting. I'm not convinced that we're going to be able to do that within 90 or 120 days, but at least it'll begin the process. I hope that his promise to convene a commission on radical Islamism comes to fruition, because this is something that Muslims need to lead in trying to figure out which are the Muslims that believe in theocracy and which are those that believe in freedom and liberty. I will tell you, we do believe the way this has been implemented, the messaging has been horrible. That bottom line is that the communication globally to State Department offices, to airports, border, et cetera, created a havoc, if you will. I understand that they had to do it right away because sort of the radicals will scatter over the next 30 days if you tell them we're going to implement it in a month. But on the other hand, there should be a way to quickly communicate that this isn't to separate families of folks that have visas, doctors that are coming to match in the March match for training programs, et cetera, that we're hearing about. But still, I would be careful not to exaggerate the impact of this. That it in some way is discriminatory against one faith, which I don't believe it is.
Yeah, because some critics of this have said, you know, why name these particular countries? Because in the past, some of the people who have attacked this country, say like the 9/11 attackers, were from Egypt or Saudi Arabia, but those countries were not included in this order.
I've said many times in the last few days, it should have included primarily also Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Pakistan. These are cauldrons for jihadism and anti-Westernism, if you will, anti-Semitism. And if you're going to really vet against jihadism, if you look, the founding fathers of ISIS are the ideologues of the Wahhabists of Saudi Arabia. So you're right. It doesn't necessarily make sense. And that's why the countries identified were not based on jihadist cauldrons necessarily, but based on governments that really are not necessarily aligned with us in the war against ISIS, against al-Qaeda, governments that are almost on the verge of anarchy, be it Libya or Yemen or Iran, which is clearly not working with us in Syria or elsewhere.
Do you or people within the Muslim community, the people that you know in this country, do you feel any sense of discrimination or scrutiny, say, within the last year or so?
Well, that's a good question. So what are Muslims feeling on the ground? I think what's happening is we have to be careful that we not look at the Muslim community through one lens. And unfortunately, the hyperbolic response in the last few days to an executive order that did not identify Muslims, an executive order that's being labeled as protecting Christians, when in fact all it says is protecting oppressed minorities, which would include Christians, Yazidis, Jews, and Muslims that are like myself, Sunni, but maybe dissident voices in the majority Sunni community that are oppressed. So, you know, we have an ambassador on religious freedom, and that ambassador doesn't say that he's only going to protect Christians. He protects any oppressed minority. So the messaging and how it's being presented in the media is very important. And unfortunately, what's happening is sort of the Muslim identity being used as a monolith and saying that, well, this is all about attacking Muslims, is belying the reality of what was the intention of this order and the fact that we are engaging, even governments, which, you know, by the way, what the mood is of the Saudi regime or the Iranian regime to this, I don't think is a barometer of what Muslims feel. What the mood is on the ground is true, and that's why your question is very correct, which is we have to be careful not to misportray what the reality is. Yeah, Muslims are feeling more fearful, and because there's, I think, a lot of exaggeration of what the reality is, and especially we have to mention this attack in Quebec that really did not get as much attention as it should. You had 6 Muslims killed, assassinated in a terror attack, which appears from a Canadian nationalist.
That is Dr. Zudi Jasser. He's the president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy and co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. The state of California is experiencing what could be considered a modern-day gold rush, though markedly different from the one that took place in the mid-1800s. The new gold, technology, and successful startups in California's Silicon Valley. It attracts people from around the world who go there and try to make it big. Tech hubs are also forming in Asia, but a different startup culture than you'll find in the Golden State. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains from Silicon Valley.
Edo has worked for tech startups in China, Taiwan, and now he's at a virtual reality startup in Silicon Valley. He says trying to start a business in Asia was much tougher than in Silicon Valley.
It's a lot harder to get investors, and they're a lot more real in terms of You know, hey, you have to generate a business model very early on and make money early on in order to support yourself.
Ho says investors are more comfortable with risk in Silicon Valley.
You know, you have a great idea, great. Go and push it out and we'll invest money into it and figure out the business model along the way.
Silicon Valley investor Tuck Luong had worked in a Chinese internet company. He says a big reason behind the difference is how risk and failure are viewed.
Asia has too much of put too much weight on how other people view the perception of you, right? So when you fail, there's a perception of, oh, you didn't succeed. But it's worse than that, because then it affects the parents and says, oh, my son didn't succeed.
In Silicon Valley, failure is not viewed negatively among the investors.
They don't avoid people who have failed because they see, okay, they've learned something from that.
Venture partner Ben Tran says, even though failure is viewed more positively here, it's still tough when it happens.
There's been a lot of people go into depression, people who potentially commit suicide. There's a tremendous amount of pressure when it comes to starting your own company. You're tying it to something with your ego and your identity.
But Tran says entrepreneurs from around the world just keep coming to Silicon Valley, dreaming of becoming the next Google or Facebook.
And you read about it in the press. And that has generated a lot of folks who, you know, do want to strike it rich, people who have a gold rush mentality.
Many of the entrepreneurs from overseas come with a strong technical knowledge, but they may not have the soft skills.
It's your ability to recruit top talent, your ability to get top talent to work together well, your ability to communicate your vision in a way that inspires them.
Silicon Valley investors are not only looking for these skills in the U.S., but also overseas.
There are parts of the world that are developing outside of Silicon Valley that are matching it in terms of drive and innovation. And we're starting to see that in parts of China.
Investors from China also are evolving.
They come to the States and they invest a lot around this area. And then they bring it back to China. And then they encourage people in China to actually innovate also.
That's our show. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
1 week after his inauguration, President Donald Trump welcomed his first foreign leader to the White House, Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May. At a press briefing, both leaders emphasized the two countries' special relationship. President Trump called it a deep bond with military, financial, cultural, and political dimensions. He said, "Together, America and the United Kingdom are a beacon for prosperity and the rule of law. Our relationship has never been stronger. Both America and Britain understand that governments must be responsible to everyday working people, that governments must represent their own citizens." Prime Minister May sounded a similar note, saying she and President Trump share the approach of putting the interests of ordinary people up there center stage. She also invoked the special relationship, noting that both leaders are ambitious to build on this relationship in order to grow our respective economies. She said Britain and the United States are discussing how to lay the groundwork for a UK-US trade agreement and identified the practical steps we can take now in order to enable companies in both countries to trade and do business with one another more easily. Such a trade deal in the aftermath of the Brexit vote, Prime Minister May said, will cement the crucial relationship that exists between us, particularly as the UK leaves the European Union and reaches out to the world. Prime Minister May spoke of other areas of agreement, the need to redouble efforts to defeat ISIS and the ideology of Islamist extremism, the importance of NATO and the necessity of seeing that NATO is equipped to fight terrorism and cyber warfare, as well as conventional forms of war. She promised to continue her efforts to encourage fellow European leaders to deliver on their commitments to spend 2% of the GDP on defense, so that the burden is more fairly shared and we are properly equipped to face our shared challenges together. President Trump said to Prime Minister May, "We look forward to working closely with you as we strengthen our mutual ties in commerce, business, and foreign affairs. Great days lie ahead for our two peoples and our two countries."